History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. John Brown was a charismatic and deeply religious man who heard the God of the Old Testament speaking to him, telling him to destroy slavery by any means. This is in antebellum America before the Civil War. When Congress opened Kansas Territory to slavery in 1854, Brown raised a band of followers to wage war, some of them including his sons. His men tore pro-slavery settlers from their homes and hacked them to death with broadswords. 3 years later, Brown and his men assaulted the federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry, hoping to arm slaves with weapons for a race war that would cleanse the nation of slavery. So this story is pretty well known to those who've studied America or know what happened leading up to the Civil War, and Brown was the most controversial figure in America after his death. Brown's violence pointed ambitious Illinois lawyer and former office holder Abraham Lincoln toward a different solution to slavery. Instead of violent conflict, Lincoln spoke about plotting his path back to Washington and perhaps the White House and settle everything with a political solution. But his caution couldn't protect him from the violence Brown had set in motion. After Brown's arrest, his righteous dignity on the way to the gallows to be hanged led many in the North to see him as a martyr to liberty. Southerners responded with anger and horror to a terrorist being made into a saint. Lincoln tried to thread the needle between the opposing voices of the fractured nation, and he won election as president. But a time for moderation had passed, and Lincoln's belief that democracy could resolve its moral crises faced the ultimate test in the Civil War. Today's guest on this episode is H.W. Brand. He's author of the book The Zealot and the Emancipator about Lincoln and John Brown. So what we're going to do in this episode is look at the story of John Brown, and we're going to ask some really big questions, like, when is the approach that Lincoln favored, finding a political solution to a horrible evil, appropriate? And is the John Brown approach, taking up arms, appropriate? This tension between these two views, this duality, is found all throughout history. You can look back at the time of the Reformation and see Martin Luther on one side and the radical reformers on the other side. You can look at the Civil Rights period and look at Martin Luther King Jr. on one side and Malcolm X on the other. You can look at the subject of British colonialism and look at Gandhi in India on one hand and the IRA on the other hand. So, in what situations is violence justified? Is it justified? These are philosophical questions, and we can look at real historical examples like this one to, if not come to a complete solution, at least get a better understanding of this question. So this is a very thought-provoking episode. I really enjoyed this discussion, and I hope you enjoy this episode with H.W. Brands. Dr. Brands, welcome to the show.
Delighted to be with you, Scott.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're talking about a figure that's well known for students of the Civil War or antebellum America. If you've taken any type of history class, K-12 education, or university, you've heard the name John Brown. And before we get into the story as outlined in your book, here's something I'm curious about. Based on your research, what is something that people would be surprised to know about John Brown? If you look at more, I suppose, traditional Civil War stories that are more pro-Southern, he's looked as really a lunatic or almost a jihadist. Northern sources, the more contemporary one, looks on John Brown more favorably, but still see him as a bit misguided. And the most pro-John Brown sources or accounts would be someone like Malcolm X, who considers him like a righteous among the nations for the African-American cause in the United States. But there's different accounts on him, but what is something about John Brown that you think surprises people that when they learn about?
Scott, if you'd asked me this question 25 years ago, I could have given you a confident answer. And the reason I cannot now is that I have very much less confidence in what I know about what people know about history. So you asked me what would surprise people. Well, to answer the question, I need to have an idea of what I think people know. And I've been teaching college students for 35 years. And I'll tell you that they tend to know less and less about history. Now, I mean, I don't blame my students. The teaching, the curriculum is different. And I get a lot, I teach at the University of Texas, and I get a lot of international students for whom, you know, they may have had almost no American history before. But I will say this, that John Brown is this polarizing character. He is, I'm not going to say he's as polarizing today as he was then, as nobody more polarizing than John Brown in 1859 and 1860 and 1861. But I will say that there are differences of opinion on, well, to put it very bluntly, was the guy crazy or not? And there were motives, there were incentives for people in his day to dismiss him as crazy. Southerners, whose institution of slavery was being attacked by John Brown, they, well, some of them wanted to say he was crazy, but in fact, that almost let him off too easily because many of them wanted to indict the North and the Republican Party in particular for spawning people like John Brown. So if the Republican Party, this is the line of many people in the South, the Republican Party is this avowedly anti-slavery party. They're naturally going to spin off people like John Brown. And you don't have to decide if you take this view, whether John Brown was a lunatic or not. But in either event, he takes up arms and he tries to incite a race war that, if successful, will certainly kill hundreds of people, perhaps thousands of people. So people then, some, they had sort of mixed, but I should add, that Abraham Lincoln, who's the co-star of my book, he didn't think John Brown was crazy, but he certainly thought John Brown was wrong, misguided, and counterproductive to the very cause that he espoused. Lincoln thought that John Brown was a net negative force for the cause of freedom, because, first of all, John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry failed. It didn't start the uprising that John Brown wanted, and it didn't free any slaves, which was the point of all of this, and it got John Brown killed. But from Lincoln's perspective, the worst part of it was that it undermined the cause of moderate anti-slavery people like Lincoln himself. Because Lincoln believed, he certainly hoped, that Southerners eventually, I'm speaking of white Southerners, even especially including white Southern slave owners, the political classes in the South, he hoped they could be persuaded to see that slavery was no longer in their interest, if not in 1860, maybe in 1865, 1870. Lincoln had seen, he lived through the time when Northern states had abolished slavery, and they had done so out of self-interest, not because anybody else was hectoring to do so, but because their economies had changed. And Lincoln believed, and he certainly hoped again, that Southern economies would change in the same way, and Southerners would emancipate their own slaves. Lincoln's belief was this was the only way it could be done constitutionally, it was the only way it could be done legally, and it was the only way it could be done effectively. So Lincoln was one who, he didn't have to decide whether John Brown was crazy or not, but he certainly wanted to distance himself from John Brown because he thought John Brown was an ill force for the anti-slavery movement.
Well, we'll get back to this question of the tension between the two of them, because this is a theme throughout history of reform, the tension between those who want nonviolence and those who are willing to use violence to affect their means. But first, something with John Brown. Could you describe for me the world of John Brown? Because it's easy for some, I think, to paint him as a lunatic, but of course, in his mind, he's being perfectly rational. And he is living in the antebellum era where there are other radical people or people who are pushing for very strong reform. Some like Joseph Smith with Mormonism, who has a millenarian look on where human civilization is headed. Who does John Brown see himself? Is he like a Old Testament prophet, like the prophet of Elijah, going after the prophets of Baal and calling down doom and destruction on them, or something else? How does he see himself? And what is the world of John Brown that makes someone like him make more sense?
The world of John Brown was changing, and it changed dramatically from his date of birth in the year 1800 to his death in 1859. And John Brown found it one of the big challenges of his life to accommodate himself to these changes. John Brown was born in New England. His family moved to Ohio when he was quite young. And so he grew up as a boy in the southern part of Ohio. It's crucial that it's the southern part of Ohio because it was a part of Ohio where kids growing up just encountered slaves. Kentuckians would bring their slaves across the Ohio River. Sometimes John Brown and his family would go into northern Kentucky and they would see slaves. And John Brown, like most kids, assumed that his world was normal. This is just the way the world is. But there was a moment in his boyhood that he recalled from years later. And he described playing with this black boy who happened to be a slave, but John Brown didn't exactly realize it while they were playing. It was only after they'd been playing for a while that a white man who seemed very angry and who seemed to be in a position to be able to, well, get away with yelling at this black boy. And then he started beating him around the head and shoulders. And John Brown was really struck by this because in his world, John Brown's world, nobody except possibly his own father could get away with this. And evidently this man was not the black boy's father. And so John Brown realized there is something different between my situation and the situation of this boy that I had just minutes before been playing with essentially as an equal. So this stuck in John Brown's head. He grew up opposed to slavery in kind of an emotional or philosophical way. But it didn't really come home to him until he was in his mid-30s. In fact, he was 37 years old. Now, John Brown's world has been changing between his birth and 1837 when this moment occurs. When John Brown was born, it's fair to say that a whole lot of people in the United States, both in the North and in the South, expected and hoped that slavery would die of its own weight. One of the reasons that slavery was less controversial, that was not more controversial than it was at the Constitutional Convention, was that most people at the Constitutional Convention thought that slavery was this dying institution. The cultivation of tobacco was wearing out the soil in places like Virginia. George Washington was beginning to shift out of the cultivation of tobacco into wheat and barley and other crops like that, crops that were grown on northern farms, and crucially, crops that didn't require or even benefit particularly from slave labor. If you grow wheat, you have intermittent need for labor. So you have to plow and you have to plant, and the stuff just grows on its own for 4 or 5 months. And then you need a lot of people to come harvest it. But you really don't have anything to do for the laborers in between. And this is why northern farmers used hired labor, not because they were more moral than southern farmers, but because their needs were different. And it looked as though Virginia was going to go that way. And the other states of the South were going to go that way too. But then the cotton gin was invented and new varieties of cotton were developed and new lands were opened to the cultivation of cotton on the Gulf Coast Plain. So this was all going on while John Brown was a young man. So slavery, instead of fading away in the South, grew more entrenched in the South. And as this happened, a lot of those people, particularly in the North, who had been hoping that slavery was going to fade away, realized it's not. And now we need to do something about it. And thus emerged the self-conscious abolitionist movement. There had been abolitionists in the 18th century, Quakers and the like, but they were generally seen as kind of a fringe. They didn't occupy sort of the central seats of power anywhere. But in the 1830s, well, in 1831, William Lloyd Garrison launches his vigorously, virulently anti-slavery abolitionist paper, The Liberator. And so the abolitionists find their voice in the 1830s. Now, John Brown's life, he's 30 years old in 1830, and his life has not been going particularly well. He was one of those people who had difficulty kind of making it in the world. He wasn't a successful farmer. He tried his hand at herding cattle and sheep, and that didn't work out so well. He got into small business again, couldn't make a go. But the one thing that John Brown seemed to be able to do pretty well to this point in his life was have children. He ultimately had 20 children by two wives. And you know, he sort of had to figure out how to support the whole bunch of them, except that this was part of the old thinking of having lots of kids. By the time the kids are 10 or 11, you know, they're able to pitch in and help around the farm or wherever they happen to be. Anyway, so John Brown is looking for a cause. He's looking for a way to make his mark. I can't say that John Brown had shown inordinate ambition. He wasn't somebody whose neighbors and friends looked at him and say, that guy's going somewhere. Now, I notice you have Theodore Roosevelt looking over your shoulder. And Theodore Roosevelt was one that people said, okay, this guy, this kid's got something inside him that's going to make him go. And Roosevelt himself used to talk about it. I don't think John Brown felt that way, but he did want to find his place. And he read the abolitionist newspapers and he listened to abolitionist speeches. And he was more drawn to the cause. But what really got his attention was the murder in 1837 of a noted abolitionist editor, a man named Elijah Lovejoy, in Illinois. And Brown concluded from this that, oh my gosh, what is this world? What is this country coming to if someone can be murdered simply for expressing an opinion? The slave power, and this was the way Brown and other people started conceiving of the South and the slave institutions, that's the slave power, it's really going beyond its bounds. It's this evil force that is attacking the North. And so John Brown, in response to the news of the Lovejoy murder, stood up in his church in Hudson, Ohio, where he was living. And he said, before the eyes of God, before the eyes of the congregation, I hereby devote my life to the contest against slavery. So at that point, 1837, John Brown is 37 years old. He has a mission in life. He's found what he believes that he was placed on earth to do.
For John Brown, was it his own personal reasoning that led him to this position, or did he claim a spiritual encounter like Joan of Arc did or somebody else that God had spoken to him to go on this mission?
John Brown never described a particular moment, no burning bush, no archangel coming in, a dream or anything like that. He certainly was religious. And it was no accident that he made his avowal against slavery in church. But it's kind of hard drawing a direct causal relationship from John Brown's interpretation of religion to his anti-slavery position, because as any student of this period knows, there were people in the South, and I can't say they weren't sincere, who said, you know, the Bible supports slavery. In fact, you know, go through the New Testament. And Jesus doesn't speak out against slavery. St. Paul, in one of the epistles, says, you know, slaves, obey your masters. And slavery is all over the Old Testament. So, I mean, I have to say that religious denominations were changing their positions. And this is when religious denominations split. And there would be a northern wing of the Baptist party and a southern of the church, denomination and a southern wing of the Baptist. But people could be quite religious and come to opposite views on whether slavery was even wrong. Because one could, I mean, an argument made again and again by Southern slaveholders was, we did not invent this institution. It's been around forever. We did not bring this institution to America. We inherited it. And the best thing we can do is to manage it as well, as benevolently as we can. And it's pretty difficult today in the year 2020 to give credit to the statement of slaveholders who said that they were kind to their slaves, they were benevolent, simply because we, pretty much everybody in the United States and in most of the world, have come to the conclusion that slavery is simply fundamentally wrong. Yet in their day, there were plenty of slaveholders who thought, okay, I'm doing the best I can. And I should add that Abraham Lincoln himself said, you know, if I were you know, given all the power to do something about slavery, he wasn't quite sure what he would do about it. Because just waving your arms and making all the slaves free, well, that would have consequences. Well, the United States dealt with the consequences after the Civil War, and it was called Reconstruction, and the 80 years, you know, almost a century, getting to the 1960s, you know, trying to figure out what all that meant. Anyway, so it was a complicated situation. John Brown's, I'll put it this way, John Brown's abolitionism was informed by his religious belief, but I don't think it was caused by his religious belief.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. Well, that's an important factor too, to understand people of this time. I, of course, there were many evil slave owners, and we can definitely understand the 21st century that slavery is an evil institution, but it wasn't easy to abolish at the time. If it were easy, then people would have done it, but it wasn't. So that makes a story like John Brown's make more sense. So from when Congress opens the Kansas Territory in 1854 to slavery, can you take us from when Brown raises a band of followers and to the point of Harper's Ferry? This is where his narrative picks up, and you'll read about it in history books. But what do you think is important to understand from this stage of the story to give better context to this story?
In some ways, the lesser known part of John Brown's history, part in Kansas, is maybe more revealing of John Brown than what is better known, the raid on Harper's Ferry. Because it's in Kansas Territory that John Brown demonstrates the lengths to which he will go in his opposition to slavery. So, just to recap, in 1854, Congress, under the spur of Stephen Douglas, Democratic senator from Illinois, opens Kansas and Nebraska territories to settlement. This meant that they would have governments, they have territorial governments, with legislatures elected by the people there. They'd have governors appointed by Washington, by the federal government. And they were in preparation for gaining statehood. When they gained statehood, when they had enough residents to qualify for statehood, those residents would get together and they would call a constitutional convention. They would write a constitution for the state. And at that time, under the Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854, they would choose for or against slavery. Now, this was a shock to anti-slavery groups in the United States because it overturned a fundamental premise of the deal that had been struck between the North and the South, between the free states and the slave states. The deal was codified in the Missouri Compromise of 1820. Which said that the northern part of the Louisiana Purchase, which basically meant the western territories, the northern parts will be forever free. The southern part might be open to slavery if the people there, if Congress so chooses, but the northern part will be free. And it was fundamental to the thinking of anti-slavery groups until the 1850s, that if we can just contain the spread of slavery, then it won't continue to grow. And this actually was a more sophisticated bit of economics reasoning that was often than was often apparent on the surface. Because by the 1850s, slavery as a way of cultivating crops had become uneconomical on the East Coast, maybe with the exception of South Carolina, but certainly in Virginia. Virginia planters could not make money growing cotton or tobacco or wheat. They only made money on the institution of slavery by selling slaves to the West, where there was a demand for slaves. And this is one where history is full of ironies. In the Constitutional Convention, the opponents of slavery managed to get written into the Constitution over the opposition of the slave owners, largely in the South, that in 20 years, 1808, the import of slaves from overseas, the Atlantic slave trade, would end as it related to the United States. But by that time, Southern slaveholders, they were quite happy for this because it basically became an aspect of what shall I call it, slave protectionism. because it meant that the value of the slaves that they owned all of a sudden rose because they couldn't be replaced by cheap imports. But furthermore, in the United States, almost alone of economies that depended heavily on slavery, slave births outnumbered slave deaths. So in the plantations of the West Indies and the plantations of Brazil, slaves died faster than they reproduced. And that's why there had to be continued imports. But in the United States, it was the opposite. So there were more slaves born than died. So the slave population of the United States grew. So in fact, the total number of slaves ever imported to the United States is around maybe a little bit less than 100,000. By 1860, by the outbreak of the Civil War, the slave population was almost 4 million. So the great majority of those were people who had been born in the United States. But anyway, but this all this leads up to the fact that slavery had to continue to expand. Otherwise, it would become unprofitable for those planters in Virginia and other places who exported slaves to the West. And so it was under the influence of that group. Stephen Douglas was a Democrat. The Democratic Party was strong in the South. Stephen Douglas wanted to become president of the United States. He needed to get the support of the South. So he opens up Kansas potentially to slavery. What this meant was that there immediately was a race to Kansas, just as there had been a rush, a race to California to grab the gold. Now there is a race, a rush to Kansas, to basically put your settlers on the ground, your being either pro-slavery settlers from the South, from the slave states, or anti-slavery settlers from the North, because of the fact that once the place filled up to the threshold for having a state, then the state, then that whatever the majority was, would decide for or against slavery. So people begin pouring in with the assistance from the South of money from slaveholders and people who have an interest in extending slavery, and in the North, from abolitionists who provide money, who provide provisions, who even provide weapons once it becomes clear that there's going to be some fighting between these competing groups. Four of John Brown's adult sons go off to Kansas, in part because they don't know what to do about their father. They had a really difficult and torn relationship with their father. But they go off because they're opposed to slavery. They're also kind of looking for a way to get a fresh start, away from home, away from dad. And they get out to Kansas Territory, and they discover that there is this, it's not a full-blown war, but there is hostility. There is, you know, sharp elbows being thrown. And they say, Father, if you're opposed to slavery, you got to come out here. So John Brown goes out. And John Brown very quickly becomes dismayed and angry at the failure of the anti-slavery side to stand up for itself. The pro-slavery side has a big advantage because slave state Missouri is right next door, and you just jump across the border. And when we talk about Kansas at this point, we're talking about really the easternmost sort of 50-mile swath of Kansas. We're not talking about far west Kansas. Nobody was settling there yet. So it's right next door to Kansas. And groups that were generally called border ruffians, they came into Kansas, and they would stuff the ballot boxes when they were electing a territorial legislature, and they would generally make havoc and physically threaten the anti-slavery immigrants. And there was one particularly notorious moment when a mounted mob of the ruffians descend on Lawrence, Kansas, which was a settlement of the Free State group, and they basically tear the town to pieces. And John Brown hears that the attack is going on. He saddles up and he rides in that direction only to discover that he's too late and the town has essentially been destroyed. This is the infamous sack of Lawrence. And John Brown can't decide if he's more angry at the pro-slavery people who destroyed the town or at the anti-slavery folks for not standing up better for themselves. So John Brown decides to send a message to the pro-slavery settlers and any future immigrants from the slave states. John Brown gathers a small band of his followers, including two of his sons, and they descend on a hamlet on the banks of Pottawatomie Creek in the dead of night, and they drag from their beds five pro-slavery settlers, men. They leave the women and children alone. They drag the men out, and they brutally murder them. They hack them to pieces with broadswords, and they leave the corpses on the ground as a message to other pro-slavery settlers. If you come to Kansas, this could be you. Now, in our day and age, this would be immediately labeled an act of terrorism. The term didn't really exist in its modern form back then, but this is what John Brown was engaged in. And this is the part of John Brown that most fans of John Brown, they try to slide over because it's really hard to justify this, even if you think that John Brown was on the right side of history. And John Brown, subsequently, he led an irregular group of militia, basically, in Kansas, in pitched battles against other people who had weapons and were firing at that. You know, so that kind of warfare is fine. They're shooting back. They haven't attempted to defend. They haven't a chance to defend themselves. But to murder people in cold blood in the dead of night, that, well, even for some of John Brown's followers, that seemed a bit too much. So this is what makes John Brown notorious. It also made him wanted for murder, except in those days, it was relatively easy to get away from situations like this because there was no photography to speak of. You couldn't see photographs of John Brown posted at the post offices. And furthermore, there was no federal law enforcement agency. There was no FBI. There wasn't even a Justice Department in those days. There was an Attorney General, but no Justice Department. And so if John Brown wandered around, he left Kansas Territory, but he wandered through the northern states, basically living off of his notoriety and raising money for his war against slavery. And by the time he leaves Kansas, he has in mind a bigger project, because Kansas was simply a holding action. Victory in Kansas meant that slavery would not expand. And ultimately, Kansas was admitted to the Union as a free state. But John Brown wanted more. He wanted to attack slavery where it already existed. And the phrase he used, he said, "I have to take the battle to Africa, to the slave side itself." And this is where he hatched the idea of attacking Harper's Ferry. Harper's Ferry, then Virginia, now it's West Virginia. And the Harper's Ferry was chosen by John Brown because there was a federal arsenal there. This is where you store the guns. And John Brown wanted to take the guns, seize the guns, and distribute them among slaves in the vicinity of Harper's Ferry. The slaves then would use the weapons, rise up against their masters, and strike for freedom. So this was John Brown's plan. And it's fair to say that John Brown was really not widely known to the world until this particular raid. People who followed the news knew about the violence in Kansas. There was a term, "bleeding Kansas," for what was going on there. But John Brown seemed to disappear as he traveled under aliases, and he cut his hair and grew out his beard, so he could get away with this stuff. But once he goes to Harper's Ferry, and well, in fact, it wasn't at all clear until John Brown was captured that this was the John Brown of Kansas. His followers called him Osawatomie Brown for a battle in Kansas. Nobody called him Pottawatomie Brown because nobody wanted to take responsibility or credit for that. But it was only after he was seized by U.S. Marines under the command of Robert E. Lee that they realized, oh, this is that guy. And then during the next 2 weeks, he was interrogated, he was tried, he was convicted, he was executed. And then he became this notorious figure. Well, notorious in the South, famous, and indeed basically idolized among abolitionists in the North.
Well, one thing I want to go back to real quick. I was very intrigued by this. You mentioned that in Virginia, they sold slaves to the West because slavery was no longer profitable. I didn't know that. Was slavery a Ponzi scheme at this point where it would have sunsetted, do you think? Or was it profitable in the West in a way it wasn't in the East?
So this is a really interesting question. And economic historians have gone at this for a long time. Was slavery profitable? And the answer is it's hard to tell overall.
Right.
I did mention that the number of slaves was growing. I didn't mention, but this is true as well, that the value of slaves was rising. So that would indicate that it was profitable. But of course, that's exactly what happened. You use the term Ponzi scheme. That's what happens in bubbles. You know, things just go up and up until they collapse. But even if one could demonstrate that slavery wasn't profitable, let's say, for the South as a whole, and if one wanted to figure all this stuff in, slavery certainly depressed the wages of free labor in the South. For example, if you were a white blacksmith, you made less money than you would because you had to compete against black blacksmiths who were slaves, you know, who were getting effectively paid less than you were. So was slavery profitable for the South overall? I don't know the answer to this, and I've never seen convincing evidence one way or the other. But it's quite possible, though, that that's not really the salient question. The salient question would be, is slavery profitable, or more precisely, does it seem profitable to those groups in the South who are making the political decisions?
Right.
And so it's entirely possible that it could have been a net loser for Virginia. But if it profited those people who had slaves to sell to the West, then it might well have lasted much longer than it would have otherwise. I'll point out, though, in 1831 and 1832, Virginia had a very serious consideration of whether slavery had become more of a burden than it was worth. And the House of Burgesses in Virginia thought seriously about this and had a debate. As late as that point, you could make the argument in the South that slavery was ill-advised, even wrong. Let's get rid of it. But the Virginia legislature did not decide to abolish slavery. And in the 25 years after that, the willingness to hear negative views of slavery largely went away. So by the as early as 1837, Elijah Lovejoy got killed for printing these anti-slavery opinions.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. Okay, well, that's a good point, because it's not as if raw economics devoid of all emotion is what's driving this. I mean, there's always human emotion tied into these things, but that was really good context. And getting back to John Brown, I'd like to hear a little bit more about his ultimate plan before we talk about John Brown, the idea, instead of John Brown, the man. He had an idea of arming slaves or freed blacks or whatever, which isn't a bad idea in and of itself. It was reminding me a bit of Charlie Wilson's plan to arm Afghans against the Russian invasion, which ultimately was successful. And people can watch Charlie Wilson's War with Tom Hanks to get more into the nuts and bolts of what that looks like. Very fun movie. Why did John Brown's plan fail? Was it because he just simply didn't have military experience? Was it half-baked in one way or another? Did he, should he have trimmed his beard to be more incognito? What do you think?
So the first thing I have to say is that John Brown's plan was a little bit more subtle than John Brown is often given credit for. Mm-hmm. John Brown was very aware of the price of a slave, and he suspected the price of slave would go up or down depending on whether that property in slaves, that was as it was defined in the South, was secure. So if when John Brown was asked, so what's your goal here? It wasn't really, when he raided Harper's Ferry, it wasn't really to get every slave in the South to take up arms and rise and launch this revolt for freedom. The idea was that enough slaves in the vicinity of Harper's Ferry would take John Brown's offer, take his weapons, and they would run for freedom. And they would, one of the reasons Harper's Ferry was chosen was not simply that it had an arsenal, but it was very near the Allegheny Mountains. And it was easy to find hiding places in the mountains. By the way, these are the same hiding places where moonshiners would hide their stills in the era of Prohibition 60 years later. But so this was the idea. And it was to these mountain fastnesses that the slave communities that would emerge there would attract other slaves. So in the 1850s, if a slave wanted to flee to freedom, that slave had to get all the way to Canada because of the Fugitive Slave Act that required the northern judges and juries and sheriffs and everybody to help in the return of escaped slaves. But John Brown had this idea that there would be these pockets of resistance in the mountains of sort of the Mid-South. And so a slave in, let's say, North Carolina would say, boy, I don't have to get all the way to Canada. I simply have to get to one of those places in the Allegheny Mountains. And the result of this, thought John Brown, was that slaves overall would lose their value because the risk involved in owning them would grow up, would rise. But this is actually giving John Brown a little bit too much credit, because if he thought about this at all, he had to know that as soon as any slave touched that musket or rifle that John Brown handed him, then that slave was under a death sentence, according to the thinking of the slave owners. And so the slave would have no alternative but to fight for his life. And by the way, it was thought that it's mostly young men who are going to accept this offer. They weren't handing out, you know, weapons to 50-year-old women or children, because he needed this army. And so he had to know that there would be, to the extent it was successful, there would be a lot of blood shed. So in effect, what John Brown was doing was trying to trigger what would amount to a race war in the South, a race of the servile class and the slaves against their white masters. So this was the plan. And this was the reason that John Brown so scared the daylights out of Southerners, especially slaveholders, because they said, okay, he is challenging not simply our institution, but our very lives. Now, was it realistic or was it harebrained? Here, I'm not in a particularly advantaged position to answer that, but I will introduce somebody who was. John Brown, almost on the eve of the raid on Harper's Ferry, met with Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass, a slave born in Maryland, escaped to freedom in Philadelphia, he was one of a rare group of slaves who had been taught to read and write, and he turned out he could read and write very well. He was very well-spoken. He was a striking-looking man, and he became probably the most prominent abolitionist in America, prominent primarily because he'd been a slave, and he knew whereof he spoke in a way that the white abolitionists in the North did not. So, but Frederick Douglass got to know John Brown during John Brown's travels back and forth across the East, raising money for his anti-slavery project. And John Brown tried to talk Frederick Douglass into joining the expedition, the raid on Harper's Ferry. And Frederick Douglass demurred. He said, no, not going to do it. And it was partly because Frederick Douglass realized, okay, my talents lie in other directions. Then I've never been a soldier and I never want to be a soldier. I can speak, I can write, but you know, I don't want to fight. But the other reason was, and he didn't exactly level with Brown regarding this, because he didn't want to discourage Brown. But Frederick Douglass realized this was a suicide mission. Frederick Douglass understood that slaves, as burdened as they were by the institution of slavery, did not usually have a death wish. And for some, there might be an attraction of trying for freedom, but most would weigh very carefully, okay, so what are my chances actually of living through this John Brown plan, this war that he's starting, and actually becoming free? And it so happened that, so Frederick Douglass says no, John Brown goes ahead with the raid, and he tries to talk slaves in the area into joining this uprising, and none of them do of their own volition. Some are kind of strong-armed into coming along, but it was a massive vote of no confidence by the very slaves that John Brown was trying to get to rise up, because they realized the chances of this succeeding are near zero. No, I'm not going to risk my life for this.
It's interesting, the first thing you mentioned, that he had the idea of making slavery unprofitable as a tactic to diminish it, which is more elegant than what I've heard typically with John Brown. It sounds like the way that some legislators who want to make coal unprofitable, if there's not the possibility of using legislation due to lobbying efforts against them, they'll think, okay, let's maybe put taxes on it so it's so unprofitable that people don't want to build a coal plant. So there's some more deft maneuvering for John Brown that we typically see. So now I want to get to, unless you have anything else to add with John Brown the man, I want to explore John Brown the idea. Was there anything else you wanted to mention there before we transition?
No, let's go ahead and go to that. So that's how John Brown survives today.
Right. So John Brown the idea is if necessary, using an uprising, since slavery is so entrenched that that is the means by which it will be defeated, because other efforts through legislation or hoping for the natural sunset isn't happening. It's become more entrenched than we thought it would have been decades ago. Now we enter Abraham Lincoln. So as John Brown becomes this most controversial person in the United States, what does Abraham Lincoln think of him when he first considers him?
Abraham Lincoln hardly knew of John Brown. He knew of this guy called Osawatomie Brown, this guy who apparently had committed these or directed these murders in Kansas, but he also seemed to have fallen off of the radar. So nobody knew where Brown was between the latter part of 1856 and 1859. And Lincoln was quite happy that nobody knew where he was, because he hoped never hear from him again, because Lincoln thought that this Brown character is bad news because, as I mentioned earlier, he is making it more difficult for moderates like himself to convince slaveholders, or at least majorities in the slave states, that their state's interest no longer aligns with slavery. Lincoln thought that there were two potential routes to end slavery in the South. One was state by state, as had been done in the North. And Virginia might be persuaded, no, it's just not worth it anymore. I should add here that when Lincoln was born, he was born in 1809, there was still a feeling in much of the country, even in the slave states, that slavery was this necessary evil. And the evil part is as important as the necessary. This was the opinion of Thomas Jefferson, for example. Thomas Jefferson was a slave owner, but he thought slavery was wrong and evil, and he spent his political life trying to end slavery. And so in places where slavery no longer became as necessary as it had been, then people could focus on the evil. So when the North eliminated slavery, so if you think of slavery as this necessary evil, well, if the necessary is as important as the evil, then maybe slavery survives. But if it becomes less necessary, then the evil stands out. And you can say, okay, let's get rid of that part. And Lincoln hoped that that would happen in places like Virginia. So one way to end slavery was state by state. Another way, and this is a bit of a longer shot, but still possible. And in fact, this is the way slavery did end in the United States, by a constitutional amendment. But Lincoln's interpretation of the Constitution, and pretty much everybody else's interpretation of the Constitution, was that the Constitution guaranteed the existence of slavery in the states where it existed. And under Lincoln's view, the president could not tell Virginia and Georgia and South Carolina that they couldn't have slavery anymore, nor could Congress. It was up to the legislatures of those states, or in the outside chance of a constitutional amendment, of 2/3 of both houses of Congress and then 3/4 of the states to say it. And I'll say that's the way it finally came about, but that was after the Civil War had changed lots of things. And so Lincoln thought that activities like Brown, all it did was to sort of put slaveholders sort of back on their heels, make them dig in those heels, come up with more reasons why they have to cling to slavery, but also it backed them into a corner. Because in the short term, far from freeing the slaves from their shackles, John Brown's raid tightened the shackles on slaves, because slaves in many parts of the South were given a certain amount of personal leeway. On Sunday, you can visit your wife and children on the next plantation. You can hold religious services. You can do whatever you want. But after John Brown, forget it. You know, we're not going to let these slaves out of our sight. And then again, and the long-term prospects were even worse, because Lincoln thought that John Brown probably set back the prospects of ending slavery in the South, you know, by a decade or, you know, perhaps a whole generation. I should add that it also complicated the path that Lincoln had charted for himself to the presidency. Lincoln had been in politics as a Whig in the 1840s, spent one term as a congressman from Illinois, then left politics, went into the practice of law to recoup his finances. The Kansas-Nebraska Act opened a window for his return, because after the Whig Party had fallen to pieces, Amid the sectional split, a new party, the Republican Party, emerged, and Lincoln was effectively a charter member of the Republican Party. So he, you know, was in at the founding of this, and he thought that he was exactly the kind of person that the Republicans should nominate for president in 1860. The arithmetic of the Electoral College by this time was such that any credible Northern candidate, more precisely, any credible Republican candidate could carry the Electoral College. There were just more states of the North and of the West, the slaveholding states. They would not have a voice in this at all. The question was, who was going to get the nomination, and would he not scare Northern voters? Nobody cared if they scared Southern voters, because again, they were outnumbered. But it's important to note that although the North as a whole tipped sort of emotionally and politically against slavery, there was a spectrum that ranged all the way from the militant abolitionists like John Brown to there were Northerners who thought that slavery was fine and let's leave it as it is. On balance, the North was mildly anti-slavery, but Lincoln, he wanted the votes of those Northerners who were not particularly opposed to slavery, because their votes counted just as much as the votes of any abolitionists.
Well, this was the conflict between the two, because Lincoln didn't like it that some people were turning John Brown into a saint. This horrified Southerners, but he was trying very carefully to thread the needle, as you wrote, of supporting the cause of John Brown without necessarily his methods. Now, one might say, well, things ended in violence anyway, so you could say, well, then John Brown was right. But as historians like you try to do, we don't want to fall into resultism that, well, because things turned out this way, this shows who was right and who was wrong, because history is not nearly that clean and neat. So do you think Lincoln could have done anything differently with this very complicated path going forward, or did he do the best he could, but things turned out the way they did? What do you think?
There's a critical moment where Lincoln could have made a different decision. Now, it's a decision that he certainly never could have made in good conscience as he understood the Constitution. He could have responded to Southern secession by saying, I think you're wrong, but it's not worth fighting a war over. He could have taken the position that James Buchanan took. And actually, James Buchanan was president when the first seven states seceded. And his position was, the Southern states do not have the constitutional right to secede, but I don't have the constitutional right to take arms against them. So off they went. And Lincoln could have said, all right, I think you're wrong, but this doesn't deserve a war. And if he'd done that, there wouldn't have been a war. This is one of those relatively rare moments in history where the decision of one person can have enormous effects, can be the difference between war and peace, can be the difference between the Union holding together and not. Now, why did Lincoln resist secession by force? Part of it was, the largest part, was that Lincoln believed that the American experiment in self-government depended on the Union holding together, on the Constitution being able to defend itself. I mentioned the evolution of thinking about slavery. But Lincoln, and John Brown too, lived through the emergence of democracy in the United States. The United States was not a democracy when John Brown was born in 1800. It wasn't yet a democracy when Lincoln was born in 1809, but it became a democracy in the sense of legitimizing and prioritizing the will of ordinary people in actually choosing their leaders and effecting legislation. It had been a republic before that, but it was expected that ordinary folks would simply defer to their betters. But by the time Andrew Jackson gets elected in 1828, it's clear that the ordinary folks, not all of them yet, but ordinary folks are taking control of things. And Lincoln becomes president after the 1860 election. This is just 32 years later. And so American democracy is still very much a work in progress. And there are a lot of people who think that it can't last. The traditional thinking about democracy was that it's just unstable. It cannot defend itself. It cannot hold itself together. And it collapses into anarchy. And so pieces fall off. And that seemed to be what was happening when the South seceded. The Union can't hold itself together. And Lincoln said, we cannot allow that to happen. Because if it does, democracy itself, what he would call a government of the people, by the people, for the people, would indeed perish from the earth. So that was the fundamental cause of Lincoln's thinking and why Southern secession needed to be resisted. There was also a practical aspect of it, too. There were people, including some of the abolitionists, when the South seceded. Horace Greeley said, let them go. You know, if you believe in self-government, you can't hold people into a union against their will. So I think they're wrong, but nonetheless, let them go. But Lincoln concluded that letting them go was not the way to avoid a war. There would be a war soon enough if there was an independent Confederate States of America. And the way it would work would be this. The South was already concerned with slaves crossing the Ohio River to freedom. But under the Fugitive Slave Act, they had to get all the way to Canada. If the Confederate States are an independent country, then they no longer had the protection of the Constitution. And now a slave living in Louisville, Kentucky, could just skip across the Ohio and that slave is home free. And Southerners wouldn't put up with this, and they would demand the return of the slaves. And Northerners would say, forget it, you're not getting them back. And probably war would result from that. So Lincoln's position was there's going to be war anyway, better now than not. But in this question of what we make of John Brown and what does it have to do with Lincoln? Well, what we make of John Brown depends entirely on one's conclusions as to whether the Civil War was inevitable as a way of freeing the slaves. I said that Lincoln, until he became president of the United States, he thought that slavery could be ended without a war. And he certainly hoped that that was going to be the case. But the war came. And it's worth a reminder to your listeners and viewers that when Lincoln went to war in 1861, after the attack on Fort Sumter, and when he called for 75,000 volunteers, he did not say, come rally to the cause of emancipation. Heck no. He knew if he had issued that call, he would have gotten some people, but not enough, not very many. Because Northerners, at that point, they were not going to go to war. They were not going to risk their lives to free slaves. There were enough Northerners who realized, boy, if those 4 million slaves are freed, they are going to really suppress the wage rate in the North and anywhere else they might go. So, you know, we don't want slavery to expand, but you don't have to free the slaves all at once. No, Lincoln said, come preserve the Union. Come defend the United States of America. The U.S. has been attacked. And Lincoln did get his volunteers. In fact, he got 150,000 instead of just 75,000. And for Lincoln, for the first year and a half of the war was not about slavery. You know, there's this old chestnut. Is the Civil War about slavery or about states' rights? Now, any historian knows that you can be about two things at once, or five things, or 10 things, and probably the more, the better explanation you've got. But for Lincoln, the war was not about slavery. Explicitly, he said, this is not about slavery. He said, it's about states' rights. More precisely, it's about the fact that I think that the states do not have the right to leave the Union. And as late as the summer of 1862, Lincoln wrote a letter to Horace Greeley, who had quizzed him on this. You know, Mr. Lincoln, what do you see about the connection between slavery and the Union? Lincoln says, my job is to save the Union. He said, if I could save the Union by freeing all the slaves, I would do that. If I could save the Union by freeing none of the slaves, I'd do that. If I could save the Union by freeing half and leave the other half in bondage, I'd do that. But my job is to save the Union. Now, he eventually came around to the position that saving the Union required, or at least would be made more certain, by freeing the slaves, but not all the slaves. Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation explicitly excluded slaves in the border states that had not left the Union. And in fact, slaves in parts of Southern states, Confederate states, that had already been secured by Union forces. So, no, only in those regions in rebellion against the Union. And he cited his powers as commander-in-chief, his wartime powers as commander-in-chief, as authority for the Emancipation Proclamation. Because Lincoln, for years before the war, and in the first part of the war, said, I don't have the authority as president to order the end of slavery. But all of a sudden, he does. He says it's as commander-in-chief. But he also knew that that wartime power would evaporate with the end of the war. And he was a lawyer. He knew that the first thing that happened after the war was over was lawyers for plantation owners whose slaves had disappeared in response to the Emancipation Proclamation, would bring lawsuits and say, you know, return our slaves. You don't have the authority to do this, which is why in the next breath after the Emancipation Proclamation, Lincoln said, and we need to write an amendment to the Constitution, the 13th Amendment, which will end this institution forever. And that's, in fact, the way slavery finally ended in the United States.
Well, I'd like to take the subject of your book and address a very large philosophical question. And we were talking about this a little bit before the camera rolled. Is the tension between those who want reform through nonviolence, like Lincoln did originally, and those who are willing to use violence to achieve their ends, like John Brown? This tension has played out all throughout history. I mean, you could think of dozens of cases of Martin Luther and the Reformation versus the radical reformers, Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X, Gandhi in India versus, let's say, the IRA in Great Britain, and on and on and on. Some people say that violence is never justified by its nature, even if it is against an evil cause. By using violence, you yourself have become evil. Philosophers would call this a deontologist. Others would say if it achieves the greater ends, then it can be justified, a consequentialist. And these questions are being addressed again in 2020 about protests for social change, where some would say that protests must be peaceful, they cannot be violent. Others would say that violence can be used to achieve our ends. So what does this story of the tension between John Brown and Abraham Lincoln, do you think, says here about the questions of using violence versus not using violence?
Yeah, so this is an obvious question to pose, especially sort of to John Brown or of John Brown. Were his actions justified? And to come to a conclusion about this, you have to answer yourself. Was a civil war necessary to end slavery in the United States? And I don't know the answer to this. None of us knows the answer to this question. A civil war did occur, and slavery was ended in the context of that. Would slavery have ended otherwise? I don't know. I'll just point out something for your readers and for your viewers and listeners. And that is that in 1800, slavery was accepted, was legal in nearly every country in the world. And there weren't very many people who were questioning it. It was just something that had been around for thousands of years. Okay, that's slavery. In 1900, slavery was legal almost nowhere. A few remnant places in odd parts of the world, but world opinion had changed. Some of this had to do with, I could say maybe, a rising level of awareness of what human rights might consist of, but a lot of it had to do with changing economies. And I was talking about a flexible workforce against a non-flexible workforce and so on. But in this context, it was only in the United States of America, all those countries in the world that had slavery in 1800, and none of them had slavery in 1900, it was only in the United States that this massive war was required to end slavery. I have to make a partial exception for Haiti, where slavery was ended, but it was in the context of an anti-colonial revolution as well. And anyway, that started in the 1790s, but leave aside that exception. So this certainly suggests that there was nothing inherent about slavery that said, you have to have a bloodbath to end slavery. Everybody else figured out how to do it peacefully, even Brazil, where slavery was a lot worse than it was in terms of the conditions that the slaves worked under than the United States. They managed to end it peacefully. So that makes me think that if decisions had been made differently, then slavery could have ended peacefully. Now, those decisions weren't made and it wasn't. But if you do think that slavery could have ended peacefully, then you have to handle John Brown with real kid gloves, because he helped bring on this, what I will now call this unnecessary war, in which 700,000 people died. Now, in his final words, John Brown smuggled a note to his jailer as he's on his way to be hanged. And the note said that the sins of this country are so great that they cannot be purged except by blood. Now, once the Civil War came and once the blood started flowing, John Brown seemed like a prophet. And even Abraham Lincoln, who began the war thinking that, you know, this isn't necessary to end slavery, in his second inaugural address, he said, it may be God's will that for every drop of blood drawn by the slaver's lash, another drop of blood must be drawn by the sword before this burden shall pass from us. So Lincoln was sort of coming around to John Brown's view of the inevitability of all of this. If you think it was inevitable, then it's easy to embrace John Brown. Because you can say the guy was on the right side of history and he helped move things along. And John Brown, abolitionists defended John Brown as saying, wait, you know, the war over slavery had already begun. Maybe it began in Kansas. Maybe it began in 1619 when the first slaves arrived in Virginia, because violence was part and parcel of slavery. So for the first time, John Brown is one of the first who's sort of fighting back on behalf of the slaves. So if you wanna like John Brown, and there's a lot to like here, because here's a guy who was ahead of his time, and he certainly was on the right side of history. Pretty much everybody today agrees that the cause of ending slavery was a good cause. But that still raises the question, in a good cause, are all tactics justifiable? And I would say no. It depends very much on the circumstance, on the context. As a general rule, I would say, if you live in a country that still operates under the rule of law, where there is freedom of expression, where there are free elections, if in those countries, then I think it's possible to make an appeal to conscience. And so I happen to think that Martin Luther King was much more influential in the Civil Rights Revolution in the 1960s than Malcolm X, because King understood that for Black people in America to get their rights, they're going to have to bring white people on board. There simply aren't enough Black people in America to make the changes in the laws. And Gandhi, his movement worked in India because there were elections in Britain. Would Gandhi's nonviolent movement have worked as resistance to Hitler and the Nazis? No, he would have been killed the first time he stood up against the government. So it really depends on the situation. It also depends on sort of how far things have gone. And I sincerely believe, and I certainly hope, that the racial tensions in this country and other tensions in this country have gotten us nowhere near the edge of the Civil War. But I mean, we certainly aren't there yet, and I hope we never get there. If we did get closer to a civil war, then conceivably John Brown's example might be more germane, but we're nowhere near there. And just one last thing, John Brown had no idea of the consequences of his actions. He wasn't trying to start a civil war in the United States. I hope that John Brown would have been appalled to know that 700,000 people died in partial consequence to the actions that he took. And if he knew that, and I have no confidence in saying this, if he knew that, maybe he would have, you know, taken pause instead of starting this thing, start that ball rolling. But nobody knows what the consequences of our actions are going to be. And we can't say, okay, time is going to justify me, and therefore anything I do is fine, because there can be a lot of collateral damage along the way.
Well, this is why I like history instead of philosophy, because we're not dealing with abstractions here, but we have case studies and stories like this to approach these questions. So for listeners who want to dive in more into this, and there's a lot more to the story, the book is The Zealot and the Emancipator: John Brown, Abraham Lincoln, and the Struggle for American Freedom. So, Dr. Brands, thank you for joining us.
Good to talk to you, Scott.
All right, well, that is all I have to say for today's episode. First off, I'd like to thank History Unplugged's Spy Masters, which you can easily become, and I'll explain what that is after listing them off. They are, in no particular order, Baron Fraza, Chris C., David Santee, Josh from VFW Post 2285, Jake Harrington, Josh Reddick, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial Las Vegas, Michael from New York, Michael Piccinetti, Nick Brooks, Rob from Chicago, Salvador Sanchez, Tom from Ohio, Moondoggy from Ohio, Bill Ivey, Bruce Ashby from Wire Meets Wood Guitars, WMWGuitars.com, Los, Sergeant Hooch, Sumo 41, and Willie from New Jersey. Now, having thanked my Spymasters, I'd like to mention some ways you can get more involved with what I'm doing with History Unplugged. First, if you want to comment on the most recent episodes, you can check out the History Unplugged Facebook or YouTube page, which are video recordings of all the episodes, and they often come out before the audio episodes do. Second, please like and subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice. This helps the show grow and find new listeners. Finally, the best way you can get involved is to join History Unplugged's membership program called the Knowlton's Rangers. This is the place where you can directly partner with me when it comes to the creation of the sorts of episodes I do, where I can most directly talk with you, the listener. I call it the Knowlton's Rangers because they were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War. Go to patreon.com/unplugged and you can join at three levels. Join at the Scout level, you'll get early access to all new episodes and completely ad-free episodes, and I have about 500 by now. Join at the Intelligence Officer level. You get all the same stuff as level one, and you also get premium episodes. I'm doing a series on the life of Audie Murphy, on Americans who fought in World War I for the French Foreign Legion, and another series on Teddy Roosevelt's adventures in the Dakota Badlands. I have about 50 or so of these episodes now. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you get all the things from the first two tiers. You get a shout out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get three hardcover books, and you can ask me a question on absolutely anything in history, and I will devote an entire episode to answering it. So check out all those bonuses by going to patreon.com/unplugged. Wonderful listeners, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next time.